I know it's a beautiful summer day outside and you're busy thinking of a million things you have planned for the coming week. But sometimes we have to step out of the day-to-day for a deeper discussion about what it means to actually be alive, to be human, to be here. And that's where our guest, psychologist Dr. Bruce Lees, comes in. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, we're going to be discussing the ultimate unknown, death. The permanent cessation of biological function. In scientific terms, it sounds so simple. But as we know and as we'll learn, it's not. People with purpose in their lives, Dr. Bruce Lee says, live lives longer. So tell us, what do you picture when you think about death? Have you ever faced it yourself? And how did that experience give you new meaning? Join our conversation today on Central Standard after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. It's something we all think about from the moment we are aware that we are alive. Some of us fear this thing. Others wait for it with the solace of faith and belief that there will be peace and happiness when that moment comes. Still, others try to live in the now and not think about it. But one thing's for certain. Thinking about death is definitely for the living. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. How are we thinking about death and dying as we tune into this show? Today, we welcome Dr. Bruce Lees, a professor of family medicine at KU, to help us explore the concept of death and dying in our daily lives. Dr. Lees, welcome once again to the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It's a pleasure, as always, to be here.
Now, we begin with these esoteric questions on these big, big 30,000-foot topics. What is death?
Well, the easy definition is that it's a permanent state. It's the permanent cessation of biological functioning. It's the loss of life. To many people, it's a terrifying, scary, spooky, unknown thing. To others, it's an inspiration to live and to live fully and to live better.
Now, as you came into the studio today, you had a different thought process than you normally would. Tell us about it.
Well, thanks for bringing that up. It takes me an hour to drive here from home, and so I always listen to KCUR on the way in. Every day I come in, I do that. And today I did something different. I turned off the radio, and I leave home early enough to see the sunrise, and that's relevant here. Spectacular this morning. So I drove in with the radio off in, excuse the expression, dead silence. Just thought about death. Just thought about death the whole time, and it wasn't at all depressing, which is really interesting.
Was it one of those superstitious things where you're like, you know what, I'm talking about death over air today. Let me really get into a meditative state.
That's partly true. I don't know why, but today more than ever, I wanted to really think about death. It is easily the most profound topic we could talk about. And so I wanted the atmosphere to be correlate well with that.
Certainly. And dead air is bad.
Yeah.
Very bad.
It was interesting as I drove in, I noticed things I usually don't notice. I usually don't pay attention to careless drivers. And thinking about death and looking around me, I saw how many people obviously aren't thinking about death. The people who text while they drive, the people who drive recklessly, the people who speed, the people who drive angrily and tailgate. It's amazing how many people live on the edge because they don't think about the consequences of their choices, in particular about how they may relate to their own demise.
What are the psychological differences between death and dying?
Well, I think of dying as the runway to death. It is the approach to death, the process. People, the unanswerable question is, when do we start to die? There are people who claim, the death process begins when we're born. So psychologically, I think death is more terrifying when one doesn't know that they're dying. Once somebody knows that they're dying from an illness or something that's somewhat gradual, I think the anxiety decreases substantially. In fact, that actually has been researched. When people are afraid of cancer, because they think they have a diagnosis. It's far less terrifying than when they far. It's more terrifying to not know that you have it than know you are dying.
And knowledge is a big factor, and we'll talk about that throughout this hour. Why do we, as a Western culture and American culture, seem to deal with death so badly?
It's interesting because there have been a lot of studies comparing Eastern approaches to death and approaches, psychological approaches to death in our society. So much of what's emphasized in our society is superficial. It's how we look and where we live and what car we drive. And, you know, the prospect, we don't give a lot of thought to the meaning of life and the meaning of death. It's almost, you know, it's almost a conversation stopper in a social situation to mention death. Or if you have somebody you love who's dying, to say that publicly, people just don't know what to say. So we fear it. We fear it.
Well, Dr. Lees, to liven up this conversation, so to speak, we actually have a clip from the popular HBO program some of you might remember, 6 Feet Under, which ended in 2005, RIP 6 Feet Under. The character Nate, if you remember, and his sister Claire, his younger sister Claire, are sitting on a bench at their family's funeral home, the first episode, actually, during their father's funeral. And let's take a look at that, and we'll discuss the implications of that and the attitudes toward death when we return from that clip, 6 Feet Under.
When I went backpacking through Europe after I quit school, I went to this island off the coast of Sicily. It's this volcanic island. And on the boat over, there was this pine box. Somebody from the island who was being returned to be buried there. And there are all these old Sicilians dressed up all in black, waiting, just lined up on the beach. And when they got that coffin to the beach, those old Sicilian women just went ape, screaming, throwing themselves on it, beating their chest, tearing at their hair, making animal noises. It was just so, so real. I mean, I'd been around funerals my entire life, but I had never seen such grief. And at the time, it gave me the creeps, but now I think it's probably so much more healthy than this.
That was a clip from 6 Feet Under, the popular HBO program about death and dying, set in a funeral home. That's Nate talking about the process of death and him being abroad and seeing Sicilian mothers and sisters and grandmothers fall over a coffin and go nuts, so to speak. Dr. Lees, talk about that, the reactions to death.
It's the most striking tragedy is that when somebody is suffering, either because they themselves are dying or because someone they love has died or is dying, when they need support the most, when they need comfort the most, when they need to talk the most, people are terrified to talk about the topic. We just don't know. We just don't know what to say, what to do. And that clip is amazing. It's amazing. If you listen to it carefully, you hear the music in the back. It's so sterile, the current way we do funerals and the current way we, well, it, I guess that's the difference between a wake, a full-blown wake and a funeral. But, you know, we don't celebrate lives enough because we don't put it in the proper context of death and dying.
There's a famous rap lyric, "Why do we not cry at birth and laugh at death?" And that's a very interesting way to look at it. Is the way we think about and process death so difficult because of the basic split between our limited bodies and our limitless minds? We think about what happens after death and all the different possibilities, but we know our bodies, the biological function, are limited.
Yeah, that's an interesting phenomenon. This might not be the angle you were thinking of, but what strikes me as amazing is that people are terrified of dying. Most people are terrified of dying. And most of the reasons why we in the West and in developed countries die have to do with lifestyle choices, smoking, overdrinking, and I could go on and on. And the body doesn't survive those kinds of things in excess. And terrified of death, we still don't take adequate care of our bodies, minds, hearts, souls, you know, while we're here on Earth. So, yeah, the body only is, we're here for a very, very small sliver of time.
Speaking of limited bodies and limitless minds, that concept comes from terror management theory. What is terror management theory? And what does it have to do with the way we think about death? Introduced by Ernest Becker.
Yeah, Ernest Becker wrote a book back in 73, I believe, called The Denial of Death, and it is a classic.
His last book before he died, actually.
Yeah, yeah, it is a classic. It's about this phenomenon that we're talking about today, that huge fear of dying that people have when they pay attention to dying. And terror management theory is about how people deal with the inevitable terror of trying to picture death. We avoid it, we ignore it, we distract ourselves, we engage in addictive behaviors instead of allowing it to inspire us. Well, that is the optimal, the ideal way of managing fear of dying is to live fully, to live fully. There's actually a book about life-threatening illnesses by Jon Kabat-Zinn called Full Catastrophic Living, and we wait for catastrophes to start to really look at our lives and what some people and see what matters and what gives our life purpose.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Our guest is Dr. Bruce Lease, a professor of family medicine at KU, and he's here discussing the concept of death in our daily lives. Kansas City, what do you picture when you think about death? Have you ever faced death? And if so, did facing death give you a new meaning or a new lease on life? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or shoot us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. We want to know your thoughts on death and dying and terror management theory and whatever else you might want to impart on a very serious topic here today on the program. Ernest Becker, Dr. Lease, says that life would have no meaning without death. What are your thoughts on that statement?
I think that's profound. I think that's been echoed by many, many other people. I know that it's part of Eastern tradition to think of life as impermanent and to make that inspiration for doing what matters now. The movie WALL-E, the cartoon WALL-E, to me the most profound part of that movie was that once people, as I recall, it's been a while, as I recall, when people knew they were going to live forever, they got lazy and fat and didn't do anything. And we are scared to death of it, and we don't let it inspire us. And if we focused on it and realized that everything is impermanent, it would make a huge difference.
One of the things Becker also talks about in his book, Denial of Death, is that each person tells themselves what he calls a vital lie about death or refusal to acknowledge mortality. What is that vital lie?
Well, I was thinking about the vital lies when you were asking me that question. If you light up a cigarette, you're lying to yourself about dying. If you drive carelessly, you're lying to yourself about dying. If you don't take care of your, if you treat people badly, you lie to yourself about dying because you don't get a second chance. You don't get to come back. At least I can't say that I know for a fact that we can come back and fix what we broke. The vital lie is it doesn't matter that I'm going to die. That's the vital lie from my perspective.
We got Jeff in Richmond. Jeff, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you. And good morning.
Good morning.
I'm a combat veteran. The second time that I was wounded, I had a near-death experience. I was unconscious for 3 days, and I went through that whole deal that they talk about. And after I returned to full life, I spent about 30 years trying to get dead again before I finally was able to get past all of that. Now, I've spent then 14 years since then being glad I'm alive and trying to make a life of what I have left. But virtually all my friends have purple hearts, which is to say that virtually all my friends have faced death up close and personal. And it makes a different bunch of people to hang around with.
Can you just say what the difference is? Different bunch
they
of people.
They live more fully in the moment. They all know that any moment could be their last.
Thank you.
They live more fully in the moment. And many of them, as a matter of fact, are intensely committed to doing things for others.
Thank you very much, Jeff, for sharing a very personal and very deep experience. And let's, in the spirit of Jeff and all of the veterans who are sacrificing their lives or have had near-death experience, let's talk about people who have seen lots of deaths, such as soldiers in the field or folks from a violent neighborhood who grew up around a lot of murder. How do they balance either the anxiety about death or desensitization or total detachment from life itself?
You know, I'm really concerned about answering the question and sounding cliche, but I'm going to just say what I'm thinking. What we have done to our vets who are returning from the catastrophes of war, what we've done is a crime. Not literally. It's just a shame. They've struggled so much with seeing so much violence and death and pain and suffering, and we just haven't provided the resources that are so necessary for helping people cope. You know, everybody copes differently with seeing death and dying, whether it's on a massive scale or a small scale. I myself watched somebody, I've watched a few people die in my lifetime. One was from a violent crime. I was walking down the street in New York and I heard noises, and the noises were two people in a tussle, and the one who died was stabbed to death. And, you know, those memories linger. They linger. If they stayed with me, I'm sure they stay even more to people who have been through war.
I've had somebody who was shot and bleeding and defecating on himself die in my arms. So it's a lot different experience when you experience that, and you look at things a little bit differently from maybe perhaps someone who hasn't. I don't know if it's a exclusive club. I don't want to call it that, but it's a different perspective, certainly.
It's interesting because on the other hand, about 20 years ago, I had a best friend die, and he was in his 50s, and his wife and family asked me to come out and spend some time with them as he died. And it was the most peaceful, loving, amazing experience that I can remember in my lifetime. They used hospice, and that's, of course, a relevant topic for when we talk about death and dying. Not only does hospice provide care that's warm and compassionate and nurturing, but they also, there's an admission when you call hospice that you're in the business of dying. Right now, that's what we're here for. We're here to pay attention to dying. And that's when that becomes a very acute focus, which is pretty rare in our world.
We have some contributions to the conversation from listeners. Claudia in Gladstone works with veterans and says she's gaining a new appreciation about death without ever having a near-death experience herself, just from working with veterans. And Courtney tweets her thoughts on death can be summed up in Gandalf's speech in Lord of the Rings about white shores and the gray veil lifting. I guess we can gather from that tweet that she feels like it's a peaceful existence, an inevitable rite of passage, so to speak. Let's go to Johnny in Midtown. Welcome to Central Standard, Johnny.
Hello, thank you. I just wanted to share that about a month ago, walked into the ER and found out over a course of maybe 4 days afterwards that I had cancer, like two mutations. And, you know, I walked in with my pericardium filled with 600 cc's of fluid. I had a pulmonary embolism in my left lung. I had two DVTs in my left groin and like six baseball or softball-sized tumors behind my intestines. And so I think it was a fairly near-death experience, according to the doctors. And since then, and I have a one-year-old daughter now, and since then my perspective on things have changed so much for the better. And it feels like 10 or 15 years of malaise from my life has been lifted. And I just want to share that the perspective that I gained from this experience has been truly positive, and, you know, with this real sense of a limited life left, it's forced me. I feel like I have no choice but to cherish and enjoy every little bit of it, and it's a wonderful feeling, and I want to share that.
Thank you, Johnny, for sharing that feeling and what must be a very painful but awakening experience for you.
Yes, thank you. You know, it's interesting. I just recently read the Steve Jobs book, and really that's about his life and death without any details about the actual dying process. And the author is very clear that when he was really suffering and death seemed imminent, it did change him. But the author also made it very clear that he rebounded back to being what he was like before, which was somebody who wasn't really thinking about dying, more thinking about the things that matter less. And his character changed a little while, but not very long.
Are a lot of our decisions based on the fear of just not physically being here anymore? Not necessarily how we go or when we go, but just physically not being here anymore.
That's, when I think about death for myself, the only fear I have is how my departure will impact the people I care about. So not being any, I almost said no, it's all about annihilation and loss and that black hole. But no, for me personally, since you asked, I love enough people that I'm concerned about how they will be when I'm gone. Not that I'm any great, terrific, awesome, amazing person, but you know, we have bonds that that we all wish would never be broken, even by death.
How does being conscientious play into how we deal with death?
That's a good light one. You know, it seems so silly if we don't like the image of death and we don't want to die, that so many of us are not conscientious about our bodies. You know, the part you mentioned earlier was that's so temporary, impermanent. You know, at the very least, conscientiousness about the basics, smoking and overeating and drinking and driving crazy and just taking a deep breath and being conscientious enough to live a full, rich, and long life.
But is this people taking carpe diem or eat, drink, and be merry for tomorrow's not promises? Is this people taking that too far or taking that too literally or taking that too far to an extreme?
How about just don't abuse yourself? just be conscientious enough to not. One of the bad things about not caring about dying is that it's not the person dying. Some people might say, well, let them smoke or well, let them, you know, beat themselves, their bodies up till they die. But the suffering other people experience, people who care about you, if you don't take care of yourself.
I have a friend, a very close friend, almost a brother, who right after September 11th, he was in Tower 7, and you know, we had a surreal moment together, something that we both share around the September 11th attacks. He narrowly avoided that, walked across the Brooklyn Bridge with the towers burning in the background and all the chaos and the ashes spreading all around the sky and all around the ground, and what looked like a refugee throng just headed across the Brooklyn Bridge there. He immediately went home and cooked a pound of bacon.
Oh, boy. Was he a vegetarian before that?
No, he was not. But he went home and immediately cooked a pound of bacon, found all the things that he enjoyed, literally all the things he enjoyed, and just did them all that afternoon.
You know, at the beginning of the show today, I said that I drove an hour here thinking about death. But, you know, it's awesome to think about the implications of dying. One of the things that went through my mind, of course, was 9/11. You know, I was thinking from the moment we conceived this show, I was thinking that an awareness of death should motivate us to be alive, to be grateful, to be compassionate, to be loving, mindful, authentic, conscientious, all those things. That's what an awareness of death should motivate us to. And what's interesting is that with all of the hate speech and anger and crazy stuff that are going on around elections, 9/11, the maybe one blessing of 9/11 was for a moment we had an example of what it would be like with widespread awareness of death and the corresponding compassion and fellowship we had for those few days after 9/11. I will never forget how kind people were after all that death and destruction.
Yeah, I remember seeing the candles in Union Square and all of that, just literally being at ground zero myself, where it's something that I would never forget. However, many would argue that after that initial sympathy, we are living almost in a permanent culture of fear.
I agree with you. That's why it's so sad, the contrast.
But the truth is, you can do everything right and conscientious and still go at any time based on any cause. Does not knowing when we die and how we die become one of the biggest sources of that fear?
Oh, yeah. Even somebody with terminal cancer, doesn't know how they'll die. They may die they will die of something, but it could be pneumonia, could be an infection. We don't know how we're going to die. We don't know when we're going to die, and we don't know how we're going to die, and that produces great anxiety if we pay attention to it and if we don't have purpose in our life. Purpose is the key to a lot of things in life.
You think of the young lady who avoided the shooting spree in Toronto only to be in Aurora, Colorado when that Batman shooting spree happened. What are the chances of that? But it happened, and she didn't make it out the second time. Libby in Waldo.
Hello. I'm gonna try to get to my part and not take up a whole lot of airtime here, but I think I do have some important points here. I was telling your screener that I'm a blind person here in Kansas City, and I travel with a dog guide. And in California many years ago, I was hit by a car, and of course, as a result of it, I lost my dog, and I didn't even know I'd lost her. But we had done everything right, and yet we were impacted. I don't know much about the accident itself because I was knocked unconscious, but I will tell you, thinking about it over these years, and it's kind of hard not to think about it, especially when I'm out there trying to get around with these cars, these crazy drivers and everything, death is going to happen quickly. I mean, it's painless, really. I wasn't aware of it at the time. When I heard later what people had seen, that is when I really became afraid, because what they described, what they saw, that's what made me suddenly afraid. But in the act of it happening, I didn't have time to be afraid. And here's my point that I want to make with that in mind. And talking about, Dr. Lee, what you were talking about, just eating and drinking and smoking and all that, when you do that, when you indulge in those activities, and this is separate from what happened to me, but in a way, when people do indulge, they're actually making a choice of how they're going to die, if not directly as a result of their habits, but maybe as a side result. But in a way, wouldn't you agree that if you indulge or whatever, you live a lifestyle that is going to lend itself towards the eventuality of your life leaving? Wouldn't you say it's kind of a form of suicide?
Well, that's,
and yet at the same time, it's not condoned.
Yeah, that's what probably the most common argument is when families try to talk to a family member about smoking or overdrinking or whatever. They say, you're killing yourself. So, that is right. You know, people do self-destructive things for a lot of different reasons. Some people are generally happy and function really well and still do those things. And other people do those things because they're suffering and they don't know how to live well. They don't have the resources to live well.
And the typical response, which I've given myself on many occasions,
is everyone's going to die of something.
Yeah, everybody's going to die of something. I can eat tofu every day and get hit by a car, stuff like that. What do you think to those responses? What are people thinking? What are they going through their mind?
That's what you asked about TMT, terror management theory. Again, that's a theory of how we deal with the fact psychologically that we're all going to die, and we don't know how and we don't know when. People use rationalizations. They come up with these little quips that they think are cute, but the topic for them probably should be, again, dead serious.
Dead serious indeed. Dr. Bruce Lease, a professor of family medicine at KU, is here discussing the concept of death in our daily lives, and ironically, it's been a very lively conversation about people's attitudes toward death. Kansas City, what do you picture when you think about death? Have you ever faced death, and if so, did that give you a new meaning? We'll continue to take your calls, but now give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can shoot us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. centralstandard@kcur.org. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back to talk about the other certainty in life other than taxes and how to live a better life as we manage the fear of death. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. The fear of death is the most unjustified of all fears, for there is no risk of accident for someone who's dead. Those are words from a remarkable man who is dead, named Albert Einstein. But you don't have to be Einstein to be thoughtful about the purpose of life in the face of death. And that's our topic today, the psychology of death and death denial, death and dying, how it plays into our everyday life decisions. Dr. Bruce Lease is our guest. He's a professor of family medicine at KU, and he's here discussing these concepts of death in our daily lives. Kansas City, what do you picture when you think about death? Have you ever faced death? And if so, did that give you a new meaning for life? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or shoot us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. Facebook is also an option. Our Twitter handle is @KCURCST. Let's go directly to Philip in Midtown as we begin this second half of the show. Philip, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. The question I wanted to raise is one of whether or not we shouldn't, frankly, allow people to own their deaths in the same way that we claim that we wish them to be able to own and control their own lives. There are circumstances under which it is quite rational, quite reasonable, that a person should choose to end their lives. Whether we're talking about people with, and I'm not talking about people with treatable depression, but when we're talking about people who, for example, are facing painful ends in their lives, terminal illnesses, or for whatever reason, those people quite rationally may decide they wish to terminate their own lives, why shouldn't they simply be allowed to do so, and do so in a simple and dignified fashion?
Thank you, Philip, for your question. This is a bioethics question, one
right.
that came up with Terry Schiavo a couple years back, and one that comes up with Dr. Jack Kevorkian all the time when you think about that. Philip makes an interesting point.
I'm happy to answer that one. What's important to remember is that the fact is that most suicides are involve being under the influence of some alcohol or drugs. Most people who die don't do it by their own hand, don't do it mindfully. It's not a careful, deliberate, thought-out process because of something that can't be fixed. So for those who ask that question, why can't we die deliberately if we truly are suffering and we truly have no solutions to our usually medical problems? The person who asked that question, I guess Philip, for example, can be told that most people who commit suicide do it pretty irresponsibly, for lack of a better term. They bring everyone down with them. The people I have known about who have committed suicide have been found by their children. They've been found in garages by, in their cars while they're running. I mean, suicide generally is done very irresponsibly. So in a world where that was handled different, maybe we could even have that conversation. But it's not the predominant occurrence that it's done that way. I will say that I once had I do teach it, obviously, at a medical center, KU, and I do have lots and lots of interactions with lots of physicians. And I once had a very rural physician who was very competent and very smart and very well respected and liked say to me, you know what, we do assisted suicides all the time. When somebody is in screaming pain and they have terrible metastatic cancer throughout their body and we can't control the pain, we up the pain medication until they just say goodbye, until they're gone. I do not know that that's a widespread phenomenon, but I think that there's more of that than we probably know, and you don't see big investigations when it's done like that.
And, of course, an advance directive is sort of a preemptive.
That's right. Good point, Jabalani. I think that's a good way to look at it. I think it's a very astute point in response to this gentleman's, Philip's question.
Gene in Fairway, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. And I just had actually wondered what your guest thought about this theory I've heard, actually, that there, and maybe I agree with in some sense, that there is actually no such thing as death. I mean, we as life, in life, are, of course, very concerned because we're living, but the Earth is a closed system, and there's nothing outside of it that we know of that relates to life, but all the energies involved here on this closed system are just changing. Energies changing and evolving into different energies. And if we believe the theory of the Christian theme, then our changing energy would be evolving to the true divine spark that we supposedly are, and maybe that is a good thing. And I'll take your comment off the air. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gene. There are a lot of people who have religious and spiritual inclinations, such as incarnation, or such as going on to glory, as my grandmother used to say, and religious and spiritual, philosophical, celestial, what have you. What is an immortality project? Because these immortality projects come up in the terror management theory and in the denial of dying by Ernest Becker.
Well, it's an effort to be eternal. It's an effort to live on even though your body is gone. Some people do it by, taking movies of themselves, talking to their families that their families can watch forever. The question that was just asked, is a very interesting question. There are some, every religion has some sort of way to deal with the concept of death. And there's a book out in the Jewish tradition called The Death of Death. And so, there's all different ways to think about death, including that it's not really death. It's just another state of being. I was a huge fan. I'll be giving away my ancient hood here. I was a huge fan of The Twilight Zone because while everybody else was saying, wow, as I did, a whole bunch of us, I'm sure, were saying, maybe it really is that way. Maybe there's a parallel universe. Maybe there's whatever.
We're talking about death and dying with Dr. Bruce Lee, a professor of family medicine at KU, the concept of death and dying in our daily lives. Pat in Shawnee writes, my cancer is not curable, although it's treatable. I expect perhaps some years of treatment. Perhaps. I must be prepared, though, but still procrastinate on completing her estate plan and preparing photo albums for her children. Even though she lives with the certainty of her death, it's brought her closer to her reality because of her cancer. She still pushes into the future. Now, Pat in Shawnee is working on her immortality projects, but at the same time has accepted the inevitability that we all must eventually accept, cancer or not.
Yeah, the thought that pops into my head is, I wonder if I'll go fast or slow. Slow enough to do that stuff, or so fast that, that there will be no preparation. We don't know, and I don't know, and I don't know if it's fortunate to be able to do that or unfortunate, and that's what can be terrifying if you're not living life fully and with purpose.
Allow me to put on my linen robe and sandals and get deep right now. I think, and I should have an echo behind my voice probably right now, I think that life itself is an immortality project.
Well,
I think we're doing it right now.
I think I said this earlier, the best antidote to the terror of the unknown of death, the best antidote is purpose in your life. The legacy, as you're saying, with your robe, with your fake robe, is that...
yeah, it's a fake robe.
is that we should be living every day to create the images that may not be in a tangible scrapbook, may just be in people's memories.
Verily, listeners, I say unto thee, life is an immortality project. Let's go with
Ouch.
To Ralph in Leawood. Ralph, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Great topic.
Thanks.
Like I told the producer earlier, I had a head injury about 2 years ago, and since then, about a month ago, I was in a parking lot and fell to the ground. An attendant saw me, called the EMS, and I had coded, and it was a reaction to a medicine that I was on, neurological medicine. And I woke up 3 days later on life support with my family had flown in, and they were all dressed for a funeral. And it was very sobering at the time. One, I don't remember anything that occurred from walking to my car until I woke up. And I know that passion and a purpose is something very important, but it's really deflated over the last 2 years, that Anyway,
Ralph,
that's a very good challenge for me.
Ralph, how has this experience changed your relationships or how you live? You seem to be a little bit hesitant to convey that to us. How has it changed your life?
Well, I'm working with someone on that. The first question they asked me was, do I want to continue with life?
Good question.
And I said, well, of course I do. And then immediately said, well, I think I do. I have every reason to. It's not a suicidal mentality. It's more like I'm working on that right now because I do have so much to live for, and it's not a suicidal. I don't want to die, but it's a it's more of a realistic approach to living that now I get to pull from aspects of my life what I want to take forward. It's very sobering.
It is indeed. Thank you, Ralph. Dr. Lees?
Yeah, thank you very much. You know, you distinguished between not knowing if you want to live and wanting to die, and they're very different. Wanting to die is an intentional thought, and not knowing if you want to live is more of a passive thought. They are different, and, you know, I think everybody at some point questions whether or not it's all worth it. I mean, it could be a fleeting moment. It could be when you have an exam the next day and you weren't prepared or whatever. But that's not an uncommon thought. The troubling thing for me about what Ralph said is that head injuries are so difficult for us to understand. We in the medical profession, whether it's psychology or physicians or even neurologists, neurosurgeons, you know, we don't know always what the real implications are of an individual's head injuries. And with all the veterans coming back with head injuries from the wars, plural, we have a huge responsibility to better understand and take care of people, because there's a loss of certain kinds of cognitive processing that would make coping with the injury easier.
A perfect example of that, Dr. Lees, not to interrupt you, is the NFL players experiencing concussions and then later committing suicide. Junior Seau, Andre Waters. The list is growing exponentially as we go ahead and as they look into trauma and injuries. JP writes in that Benazir Bhutto, the former prime minister of Pakistan, told her daughter not to worry about her as she was sending her daughter to safety out of the country. Benazir Bhutto was a physician as well, and she knew she was a target for assassination. She said, dying is not a big thing. It only takes a few minutes. Don't worry about me. She was killed violently, as we all know. Right. Benazir Bhutto was in Pakistan when she returned from exile. Talk about that. Even Martin Luther King sort of said the same thing. Longevity has its place, but he's seen the mountaintop.
Yeah. I'm not so much afraid of dying or death for myself as I am for losing the people I love. And it's pretty courageous of a parent to face that head on. I do think the show would be incomplete without us talking about the five stages of grief by Kubler-Ross. Just really quick, they aren't stages, but they are valid concepts. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. They don't happen in any order, and people don't necessarily experience any or all of them. But what's important here in me saying, well, the reason why I'm saying it now is that Ralph talked about a variety of feelings that are part of his grief. And grief is real, and those aspects of grief can be real for anyone who's suffered.
Vicki in Weatherby Lake, welcome to Central Standard.
Oh, thank you. I was calling to relate my story of almost sudden death. My aorta dissected while I was driving home from school one day. And I knew what it was because I had read up about Marfan syndrome, which is what I have, and I knew I was probably going to die if I didn't get out of that car. But my reaction to that was, first of all, to do everything I could to get myself out of the car and roll out onto the road so somebody would see me. But my obviously I survived, and it was a miracle. And after that, I found I became very impatient with people because I just became impatient that people were wasting time or arguing about what I thought were trivial things and politics just drove me crazy to listen, you know, to the political speeches and stuff like that, because it seemed like people were wasting their time on so many trivial things and not, you know, just cutting to the chase.
That's a huge thing that Vicky brings up. When you have a near-death experience and you're trying to make a transition back into a normal, everyday experience, whether you're a vet or whether you're a person who's experienced being close to death, you have to come back to humanity. And sometimes you don't respect the people around you because you maybe you think that what they're talking about is trivial compared to what you've just been through. How do you balance that?
Wow. We have, again, back to veterans, we have thousands and thousands of veterans who are coming home looking at some of the things we worry about and understandably saying,
are you kidding me?
Are you kidding me? Yeah, exactly. One thing to keep in mind is that morbidity, mortality, people in the process of dying, people very, very sick, tend to become magnifications of who they were before they got sick. So it could, I'm not talking specifically about Vicky, but somebody like Vicky who may be impatient after that may have been a real go-getter, hard worker, you know, very type A, and that'll just become magnified. Now, Vicky might be at home saying, no, I was the most mellow person on earth until this happened, and that could be true also. But we do become magnifications of ourselves under dire circumstances.
This is Central Standard on 89.3 FM, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Our guest is Dr. Bruce Lee, a professor of family medicine at KU, and we're discussing the concept of death in our daily lives. JR in Midtown writes, how has Western medicine's save life at any cost mentality skewed our mental health perceptions on dying?
Well, you did talk about advanced directives earlier, and for those who are not familiar with them, they should become familiar with them. As the phrase implies, it's in advance of dying, you direct the physicians to handle your condition in a certain way, and Western medicine has to back off after a point, if that's when you say in your advance directive, back off. So many people feed that system, encourage that system, want that system to be that way. That it's hard for being at KU Med, I know that we never know in advance whether people want the full Monty or whether they want, you know, to just die comfortably. We have to be told that. We have to understand that.
The full Monty.
Did I say that?
You did. Jeff writes, my uncle died last weekend, a week after walking to the hospital to have his gallbladder removed. During the procedure, he was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer and was heavily sedated until his death. Because he waited for the 90-day insurance gap to expire at his new job, he didn't have his abdominal pain checked out. As a result, he delayed diagnosis and missed any opportunity to prepare for death despite being 70 years old. While we weren't close, Jeff says, it pains me for my dad. This was his uncle, Jeff's uncle, he was talking about. I hope that your program will remind people to prepare for what is inevitable. How do we prepare for what is inevitable? That's the biggest question of all.
Well, there are so many different scenarios. It's inevitable that we're going to die, but it's not inevitable that we're going to die in a particular manner. What he describes is a tragedy, and it's amazing how controversial taking care of one's body through medicine and the financing of that, the cost of health care and health care coverage. It's amazing that it's become such a volatile issue.
Charles Bukowski says it's less expensive to die than it is live.
Yeah.
And that's a huge thing in our society. What's the enduring challenge, speaking of which, in psychotherapy, in dealing with death and dying and our attitudes around it? What is the enduring challenge there?
Heal thyself, psychologist or physician, heal thyself. I believe that to help people who are suffering from anything, it's most important to shore up one's own values and one's own beliefs and not impose them on other people. I don't know what death will bring, but I need to be very, very open to the experiences of those who are dying, those who have lost somebody, those who, whether it's a seeing eye dog, we heard earlier about from Libby, or if it's, you know, the challenge is empathy, compassion, being present in the moment, all the things we're supposed to wake up to because we know that death is inevitable.
I'm glad you brought up Libby, because Libby writes in and says she believes that we don't want to be forgotten, thus how we live our lives is vital. But what part of this is ego?
I chuckle because you and I have talked about ego in the past.
We have.
You know, ego. I'm gonna use that question to actually touch on some death and dying literature that exists. The healthiest way to adapt to the fact that we're all gonna die is to build true self-esteem, and true self-esteem comes from nurturing ourselves, nurturing other people, challenging ourselves, challenging other people to do the right thing. When we do that, my hope and my understanding is that death just becomes part of the cycle of life, and losing those we love is excruciatingly painful, but it's still, you know, it's still part of the cycle of life. So ego, I've always said that ego is a prosthesis for people that have poor self-esteem. It's a shallow, kind of fragile, kind of weak way of feeling good about oneself. Truly getting out there and having purpose and meaning and caring for others, that makes life. That keeps us alive instead of dying.
What's your advice for people as they listen to today's show? What space can we create to process death?
I wrote it down, and I could read it, but I'll
just... tell me off the cuff.
Yeah, I'll tell you off the cuff. The bottom line is, in the face of the fact that we're all going to die, live life fully.
That's very poignant advice. Dr. Bruce Lease is a professor of family medicine at KU, and he was here discussing the concept of death in our daily lives. You can catch our conversations on ego, anger, character, love, lies, mindfulness, and today's show on death on kcur.org. Our past discussions with Dr. Bruce Lease. Dr. Lease, thank you once again for coming.
Thank you, as always.
And tune in tomorrow when we talk to the host of a new show on Hulu.com about history. In this show, historical objects and people talk back to us, and they're pretty funny when they do. Our show is produced by Andrea Salenzi, who will soon be leaving our show for an Antarctic expedition and studying the mating habits of polar bears. Up to Date is next with a talk, TED Talk, TED XKC speaker and author Athena Doctrine, How Women and Men Who Think Like Them Will Rule the Future. I'm Javelani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.